right. Good morning, everyone. We are continuing our study of the last week of Jesus here in the auditorium class. And last week, we were in Tuesday, and just a reminder to everyone, remember, we're trying to slot the Gospels into the days of the week that these parables and teachings of Jesus and things took place. And for the most part, I'm just throwing out a ballpark figure, probably 85% are clear which day they occurred. Maybe about 15% we're having to do the best we can to figure out what day that is. But last week, we were in Tuesday, and we were talking about the temple teachings. I remember how Jesus went into the temple that day, and he started talking about different stories and parables with them, teaching right there in the temple, okay? And the Sadducees and the Pharisees are there. Remember, they came back at him, trying to trick him about the, you know, do we need to pay taxes to Caesar? They did that one with him. And then the Sadducees came up with, what about this guy this lady has been, you know, married to seven different brothers, and whose wife is she going to be? Remember that? So they're trying to trick him in the temple, and he's still teaching. Well, time got away from us, so we had to stop there. Today, you go ahead and turn to Mark chapter 12. Okay, so we're still Tuesday. He's still in the temple teaching. And he kind of turns the attention to them in just a moment. But this last person comes up and tries to challenge Jesus a little bit. And Mark 12, and let's just go ahead and read 28 through 34. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, now Luke says this calls the scribe a lawyer, okay, Luke's account. So he heard the Sadducees and the Pharisees reasoning together, perceiving that he, Jesus, had answered them well, asked Jesus, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, hear, O hear, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And the second, like it, is this. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. So the scribe said to him, well said, teacher. You have spoken the truth. For there is one God, and there is no other but he. And to love him with all the heart, with all the understanding, with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. Now when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. But after him, no one dared question him again. All right, so now Luke says, what is the greatest commandment of them all? Okay, here, in Mark's account, he says, what is the first? You look at Luke, it's what is the greatest command. Why do you think, all right, this scribe, this lawyer of the law, why does he propose, if he's going to be trying to trick Jesus somehow here maybe, or get him tongue-tied or whatever, why would he ask him what's the greatest commandment in the law? What could be a possible reason that might be a tricky question? Any ideas? Okay. So it turns out that one of the things that the Pharisees and Sadducees would always discuss, they love to debate among each other, is what is the greatest command or what represents. So this was something they would discuss all the time amongst themselves, is keeping the Sabbath holy. Is that the greatest? Does that represent everything? Does tithing, does that represent everything? Sacrifices on the altar, is that what's the greatest thing? So like Don said, that they're already discussing this kind of question, so they're thinking, well, maybe, because this scribe, this lawyer, he's well versed in the thoughts around this, Let's just see what Jesus says, and maybe he'll say something that will make him not look so smart, you know, maybe make him look a little foolish, okay? Well, when Jesus answers this way, I mean, it's kind of hard to undermine that answer, right? As a matter of fact, the scribe actually confirms and says, "You're well said, good teacher. You answered well on this one." And, you know, whether or not Jesus, when he says in verse 34, he says that you are not far from the kingdom of God. What does that mean? What do you think Jesus is saying to him? You're not far from the kingdom of God. Why would he tell him that?
He has the knowledge, but he hasn't used it correctly.
Okay. So speaking spiritually, he's thinking in the right way, maybe. So he senses this guy is thinking and understanding God's word like he needs to. It's not quite there yet, right, from a spiritual standpoint. And maybe also a double meaning here is that physically, he's not far from the kingdom of God, right? He's seeking, and the kingdom is about to occur, right? Because when, you know, Christ arises, you know, 40 days later, day of Pentecost, the kingdom is right at hand, right? It is about to come, and he is seeking. All right, so that's really, from that time forward then, really, there's not really much going on that we can see where they're coming after him and trying to trick him to do something different. So now Jesus now kind of goes on the offensive. He kind of takes it to them a little bit here. Now remember, they're all in the temple up here, and there's just all kind of people listening, Pharisees and scribes. So look at Matthew. We're going to spend the rest of our day back over Matthew's account, Matthew 22. So Jesus, he's going to serve up a softball of a question here, but let's just go ahead and read chapter 22, verse 41. And while the Pharisees, wait a second. Okay, verse 41. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, saying, "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?" Now, you think, do they know who the son is? Whose son Christ is, or the Christ is? Do they know who that, through their prophecy? Who's that supposed to be? That's an easy question for them, right? It's David, right? It's David. They say, well, the son of David. They know through prophecy that they believe and know, especially the Pharisees, okay, that the descendant of David is going to be the Christ. They're thinking a physical ruler, right? So then, that's a softball question. That's an easy one. Okay, then he follows up with the second one. So he said to them, "How then does David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying," he quotes, "the Lord," which is Jehovah God, "said to my David, Lord Christ, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." If David then calls him Lord, how is he his son? Oh, got him in a hard question here, okay? So by asking that second question, how can David call one of his descendants Lord, is confusing to them. How could David call his descendant, who's going to be the Christ, how could he call him Lord? What way could he call him Lord? Could he, if he knew, if David's descendant, okay, going all the way down to the genealogy, if David's descendant, okay, is going to be the Christ that they think is going to be on the white horse with the sword, and he's going to kill the Romans, and he's going to conquer the earth, and he's going to be, would that be a descendant from David straight? It would be, right? But how could he ever be his Lord? He wouldn't ever be David's Lord in that sense. Physically, right? He would never be his Lord. How could, it's an easy question, how could Christ, the Christ, be his Lord? Well, spiritually, it's divine, right? In the spiritual sense of things, they're not thinking spiritual, they're thinking physical. From David's seed is going to come the spiritual Messiah. It's going to come Jesus Christ, yes. And he will call him Lord because he is Lord of everybody. He's Lord of Abraham. He's Lord of Moses. He's Lord of David. He's Lord of everybody, right? So they don't understand that. They don't get that. They don't see that. And again, they only see the Messiah as the earthly kingdom setting. Let's look at Psalm 110. Someone read that for me. Psalm 110, verse 1. Okay, that's what we just read. Where was Christ when David wrote that? Where was Jesus when he wrote that? Where do y'all? Heaven. Don says heaven, right? He was in heaven, right? He was spiritual. He was in heaven at that time when he wrote that. All right, so now he gets into this. We're going to move past that. He's got them dumbfounded, and now he's really going to lay it to them. So look at Matthew chapter 23. We have the woe to the scribes and Pharisees chapter, and we know about these. And, I mean, you got to remember, I don't know when you study this in the past, I say this over and over, but think about this. I mean, this is 2 days before the Sabbath, 3 days before the Passover, I'm sorry, 2 days before the Passover, 3 days before he's going to be crucified. Okay, he's about to die. These are the last words he's going to speak in his teachings. He's in the temple on Tuesday. Doesn't lock on Wednesday. He goes to the temple. Okay? And then Thursday, they're going to be getting ready for be in the upper room and be ready for the Passover feast that night. Okay? Then it's going to be Gethsemane into the wee hours of the night, Friday morning. Then Friday, you know, he's going to be arrested and he's going to be taken and crucified on Friday. So these are the last things. So the scribes and Pharisees are done. They're going to be all about trying to catch him now and just arrest him. But right now, he's got one more thing he wants to see. And he's fixing to say these things, and they're harsh things, but the people that are going to be there, you know, the lower people that are there, the poor people, the people that are being at the mercy of the rulers of the synagogue, and how they've been mistreated, and how the Pharisees have just subdued people, and how they put all these burdens on there. So I want you to kind of just go through with me. I'm not going to read all of chapter 23, but if you've got it open, you can kind of go through as we go through. So verse 3 through 4. He talks about them laying oppressive burdens on others. You know, rules. They put all these rules and just burden down the people trying to worship God and to walk according to God's ways. Verses 5 through 10, do their works to be seen of others and live, you know, for the praise of men. So it says they got their big garments all floosed up, you know, look so great. They want to sit at the best seat at the banquets. They want to be at the best seat of the synagogue. They want to be greedy with the right names. Oh, rabbi, teacher, you know. That's all they care about, the Pharisees. Verse 11 through 12, he reminds them that the greatest will be humbled and those that are the lowest will be exalted. And remembering Jesus and his service as a servant. But they are not that way at all. But then you're looking on down in the chapter, verse 13, now they shut up the kingdom and their teachings. They don't allow people into the kingdom because of the way they're profane and teach. They steal from the vulnerable, the widows. You know, they take advantage of those situations. They led their converts. Even when they go after a proselyte, because of their teachings and the burdens they'd put on people, they would bring a proselyte in, you know, a Greek, and convert them to Judaism. And yet they imposed on them these things and led them down the wrong path. They made false and deceptive oaths. Look at 16 through 22. It's amazing what they were doing. Now, I don't know about y'all. So they would, let me say what they would do. They would say like, okay, I'm going to take an oath on the temple. Okay, oath on the temple. They took an oath on the temple. Well, it's not really binding. But now if you took an oath on the gold of the temple, ooh, that's serious. That's binding. You know, or if you took an oath on the altar, okay, where the sacrifice was, well, that's somewhat binding. But if you took an oath on the gift that was put on the altar, oh, you're held, you know, held to that. So it kind of reminds me of me and Janet, you know, like in our marriage. So, like, you know, we will make commitments to one another. You know, I'm sure it's like this in your marriage, right? So we, you know, I'll tell her, I'll agree, okay, I'm going to do this or whatever. Now, if I say that, then, you know, I'll be held accountable for that, and I'll do it. But now my little finger's like this. If I cross my fingers behind my back, y'all know I'm not held accountable to that, right? That's kind of like what they were doing here. It's so ridiculous. You know, they weren't people of their word. And then going on, so he's just going after them. Verses 23 through 24, They're obsessed with the trivial, ignore the weighty. I think sometimes we could be this way. You know, they're making sure that they're tithing over the cumin and the anise or not. However you say that, the different things, or all the little bitty things, or making sure they give a tenth, but the weightier matters of the law, they don't care about. They're so obsessed with the smaller things. And then 25 through 26 or 27 through 28, he just goes after how impure they are on the inside. All they care about is how they look, and they're not pure on the inside. And you can see those passages there if you go with me through there. Then in 29 through 36, he hits them up at the very end about honoring the dead prophets and murdering the living prophets. You know, they hold the prophets in such high regard. They really do, the Pharisees. But yet, if you go back in time, you know, the people are the ones who end up killing some of the prophets. And then all the way to now, you have John, who was a prophet, a messenger of God. They killed him. They've had him lumped off. And now they're about to kill Jesus. You know, so he's telling them, you're the very ones who killed the prophets. Well, hey, now, if you're a Pharisee or a Sadducee and you're hearing these words, oh, my goodness, I can only imagine how you're just boiling within. Right, you are boiling within of anger. I mean, you're so done with this man called Jesus. Now, if you were a common person right now, you're probably thinking, you're not telling me anything I don't know. You're not telling me anything I don't know, Lord, because I see this. I see it. You're right. I feel like I've been beat down, you know, by what's been going on with the people who are the temple, who are the Sanhedrin. Yeah, I have been taken advantage of. Yes, I feel beat down. I feel like there's a lot of show and all this and not heart. So that's my opinion. I believe that we would see that. Any comments or questions about woe to the scribes and Pharisees? This is like his last time he's just going to say, I'm just going to tell you like it is. You know, he's been speaking in parables a lot in his teachings, but now he lays it out there pretty. They just couldn't see it. I think part of their influence of that too, David, they were so stupid they couldn't see it, is what you said. And I think what with that too, they gained so much power. And this whole system that they had was so important to them that they refused and just couldn't see it, you know, because it was all about them and their power and what they were doing. And it blinded them. Good point. All right, so look at the end. That brings us to the end of chapter 23. Again, we're still Tuesday evening, all right? And now it gets really interesting. So we're going to get into some predictions about the future here, and this is we won't probably finish this up today. Depends on how deep you want to go with this. It's a really fascinating chapter 24, chapter 25 of Matthew, and what does it mean and what does it not mean? But if you look at the very end, let's look at verse 36, okay? Well, we're in chapter 23, starting in verse 35. That on you, okay, so Jesus is saying that on you, you all you scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees, okay, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Okay? It's important to know that. All these things will come upon this generation. And when you say a generation, you know, generations are kind of popular right now, right? You know, you're the baby boomer, the greatest generation, the baby boomers, the Gen X, don't know all the levels of it. I just know I'm proud to say that I'm a baby boomer, because 1964 is when I was born. I'm the last year of the baby boomers. But when you say a generation in the Bible, a generation means roughly 30 to 50 years. That's a generation of people. When we say that generation of people or whatever, that could range from, you know, roughly 30 to 50 years. You know what that means, generation of people, right? It comes forward. He's saying within this generation, he's talking right now, you people, this generation, these things are going to come to place. The blood, okay, of what you've been doing is going to be held accountable to you. Well, we're going to get, that's going to be the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And really, Judaism's going to end the way of life, the way it's been doing. It's going to end at that point in time. So let's look at chapter 24. All right. So they're in the temple. Okay. They've been in the temple the whole time when he said everything he just said. Verse 1, then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. Now, why are they showing him the buildings of the temple? Have these disciples, first time they've been in the temple, it's just like going to Disneyland for the first time. Like, oh my goodness, look, just look at this. This is amazing. I mean, is that what it is? Are they just blown away by what they're seeing for the first time? No, they've seen this. I mean, how many times have these disciples who are in Jerusalem been to the temple over their lifetime? Why is it that they want to point out all the structures of the temple as they're walking out? What do you think? Well, he's been telling them, right? He's been telling them that the temple's going to be destroyed, that everything's going to be destroyed. Maybe they're thinking one more time, hey, you know what, Lord, I mean, are you really sure about that now? Are you really sure? Because look how grand this is. Look, I want you to look, Lord, see how beautiful it is. Look at these big blocks. Are you really sure, Lord? Are we hearing you right, maybe? You know, I mean, maybe, you know, there's got some doubt here. One more time, are you sure about that? So he says in verse 2, and Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. And 40 years later, there's going to be destruction, and it's going to take place. Yes, sir? It's the buildings, right?
It's still there. We
yes.
Right by.
Yeah. Well, one of the walls is still there, right?
Not the buildings.
Yes.
The
base of it.
Not
yes.
The foundation.
Yes. Yeah. Good point. Good point, Jay. So, yeah. So the Temple Mount, you know, I've shown you pictures of how it probably looked. So everything on top of the mount was just torn down. All those buildings were wiped away that you could see. But doesn't mean that every single stone at the base of it was you know, done away with. So you can see there, Josephus, I was looking at this, and it surprised me. There are some stones that are 70 feet long, 10 feet wide, or deep, if you will, and 8 feet high. So really, really large. And then later, okay, then later, look at verse 3. Now, so they've walked out of the building, out of the temple, right? And I've shown you pictures before of how Jerusalem probably looked. Now they're going to leave go through one of the gates of the wall, which is going to be, you know, most likely on the east side of the mount. And they're going to go out through the Kidron Valley, and they're going to go up the Mount of Olives. And verse 3, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives. Okay, so now they're taking a break on the Mount of Olives because they're headed back out to Bethany to spend the night again. And he's sitting there, and they're gonna want to discuss again things. They're kind of concerned and don't quite understand what all he's said so far. So he describes what they can expect leading up to the destruction of the temple. And that's what he starts to do in verse 3 through 4. I'm going to read just a little bit here, not all of it. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Okay, so you could go on and read about the Great Tribulation. So now Jesus is getting clearly into predicting the future. Now, what's the future he's predicting here? That's the key. So he's letting them know here that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. And it's going to happen within this generation. There are some key passages we need to be aware of. And that one there, Matthew 23:36, this generation, now I talked about that before, he's talking to the people that are currently living there. And we know in AD 70, General Titus, he will destroy it, and none of the buildings will be left. Now, I just wanted to get another picture. This is a different picture I found, just to get an idea. Okay, if you were sitting on the Mount of Olives and looking back over to Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives goes up higher. Now, I've shown you a picture of that before, how it actually goes up above. But here, possibly they've stopped and looked back. They're sitting there. Now, you think they're looking at the temple, and they're looking at the buildings of the temple. And now they have some questions for him. And if you look at the three Gospels here that talk about this question, it looks like there's three questions here they're asking him. So go back again and look at verse 3. Got that pulled up there? You can see it? There's three questions kind of there. So when would these things, the destruction of the temple, come about? He's talked about that. So when's that going to happen? They would want to know that, right? When is that going to occur? And then can you tell us, Lord, is there any signs about when that's going to happen? So we'll get a heads up. When will we know that? And then the third one, will there be any signs about when the end of the world is going to happen? Now, they're thinking that the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in AD 70, they're thinking that end of the world is going to be the same. That's what it looks like to me. They're kind of thinking that they're both of the same thing. Lord's going to come back, destruction of the temple, everything, end of the age, everything's going to happen at the same time. And he's going to clarify here in these two chapters that, no, there's two different things here we're talking about that's going to occur. So the end of the age is Jesus, you know, again, referring to his dealings with the Jews coming to an end and the temple coming to an end. Is that what he's dealing with here? And if you look at Matthew 24:34, so for the next little bit, this is going to be a key passage. So look with me, please, if you're not there already, Matthew 24. In verse 34, it says, assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. So basically he's saying everything prior to verse 34, all right, everything prior to verse 34, which is all of chapter 24 that he's got here, which we haven't read all that yet, but he's saying all of this is going to take place within this generation. So that means it's going to take place in the next few years, the few decades, right? It's going to take place. And he's given them signs here. So if you look down through there, and again, without trying to read the whole passage, look at verse 15 of chapter 24. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down and take anything out of the house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get their clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or in the Sabbath. Now, one of the things here that's common with a lot of people who call themselves Christians is premillennialism, right? You know about premillennialism, where that's where people believe that there's going to be a rapture, you know, the Lord's going to come and everybody's on earth as a Christian is going to be raised up into heaven. There's going to be 7 years of tribulation. There's going to be two antichrists. They're going to have a pact. One of the antichrists is going to stand in the temple and claim to the world that he's God. And then it's going to be a terrible time of tribulation on earth. And that's why the people that are Christians are going to be raptured up. You're going to go up just like that. You're going to be held in heaven. And then at the end of 7 years, then that's when the Lord's going to come back. He's going to have his 1,000-year reign. It's going to be physical armies, Russia and China is going to bring all these armies into Jerusalem. There's going to be just, you know, and then at that same time, when he comes back, all the people that were raptured that are Christians will come back to earth, and all the Christians that have died, okay, Christians, not, you know, they will be, they will also be there. So it's a big study. We've done a quarter on premillennialism about 15 years ago. Maybe that's something we need to look at again because it's so prevalent in people's beliefs. They believe, basically, chapter 24 is in chapter 20 and into chapter 25 is talking about all this is Jesus telling them about. This is when I'm going to come back and reign 1,000 years. I'm getting, you know, these signs. You get ready. You get ready. When you see these signs about the earthquakes and all this, then you know I'm about to come and we're going to have my 1,000-year reign. Not true. Not true. He is talking about things that are going to take place in this generation. And the things he's describing here is exactly, and we have now hindsight, we can see this is one prophecy of Jesus we know has taken place. We have history. We have Josephus. You can read him. We know the temple was destroyed. Judaism was destroyed in AD 70 for all practical purposes. I mean, the hub of Judaism was destroyed. And when he's talking about, you know, like in verse 17, 18, and 19, you know, he's just warning them, I'm giving you signs. You need to be aware. It'd be better for you if you're on the rooftop, which, you know what, they would sleep on their rooftops because it'd be warm. You know, they have sun, they take naps up there. So if you're on your rooftop, okay, and you see the Roman army's about to come, you don't even waste time running into your house and getting your belongings and packing up. You better get out of there. You better hope it doesn't happen on the Sabbath. Why would that be a problem? Well, you know what, on the Sabbath, they locked the gates in Jerusalem. All the gates were closed, okay, and locked. So it'd be hard, you know, to get out. You know, obviously you don't want to be pregnant. 9 months pregnant trying to run, or in the wintertime when everything, all the rivers are swollen and it's cold and you're homeless. He's giving them warnings here of escape, of letting them know, hey, when this happens. And this whole thing of abomination of desolation, that's just the Roman army. Luke says the desolation will occur when the army, Roman army, gathers around the city and circles the city. And I talked about that a few weeks ago, and I don't want to go back into all that again about how bad it was during that time and what happened. It was terrible. But he's letting the Christians know here, he's letting the people know here that what's going to happen. All right. So now if you go back over and look, go back to verse 34. Let's see if I missed anything here I wanted to. Hey, Nate, it's not moving forward. Do what? Oh, no, I got a bunch of more slides. That's the last one you got. Okay. All right. Do you have the last one, the old one on there still from last week? Yeah, pull that one up for me. Okay, so if you look at verse 34 again, now look at verse 36. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
I had been in audio classes, but you may have talked about it, but this one always gives me trouble.
29 through 31?
Well, yes.
Yes. Can we hold that for 1 second? I'll fix to talk about it because it's, yeah. Okay. All right, so then in verse 36, he says, but of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Now he switches gears. Now he's talking about the day of the Lord, when God is going to come back and there's going to be a judgment day. Did you get that back up, Nate? It is up? Okay. All right, so good thing I have me a hard copy here. So if you look at some words here that we need to know about, he uses those days. Look in verse 22 and verse 29. He says, those days. those days, referring to, again, the time that's going to happen in this generation, which is going to be destruction of Jerusalem. But then he also uses, in verse 36, that day. We just read it, but that day. So those days and that day. That is a distinction between the plural of those days and the singular of that day when it's going to happen. But there is a confusing passage here. And I'll say, too, if you go on down through there, if you read the rest of this, he's going to talk about watching and being ready for when the Lord comes again. And then he goes through all these stories, which we'll talk about next week, about the faithful servant and the evil servant, about the foolish virgins who didn't have the oil with them and they weren't ready for the bridegroom. Talks about the parable of the talents. That's all talking about the judgment day. That's talking about when Jesus comes again. Okay, so clearly he shifts. But there is a really confusing passage. And it's the one Pat just mentioned. So if you look at verse 29, and let's just start there and read. So immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with powers and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now, what does that sound like? It sounds like Judgment Day, right? It very much does. But I think we have to really take a closer look at that to see, is he really talking about Judgment Day? So one thing is this is placed in this whole passage where he's talking about clearly prophesying the destruction of Jerusalem, destruction of the temple. But you notice in verse 29, okay, it says immediately after the tribulation of those days. Immediately. This is not something that's going to take place some distance of time, but immediately this is going to take place. And if you look further, and I don't know how far we need to get into this discussion, so you give me some feedback afterwards if we want to go further into this. But if you break down this verse 29, okay, it says, in those days the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Well, that could be very symbolic. And there's about six passages, and I've got them on the slide. There's about six passages in the Old Testament that talks about these very things, about the stars falling. It describes when an empire ends. It describes when a king loses power, okay, an end of something. Well, you know, this is basically, as far as God's concerned, the old law, Judaism, this is done. It's over with. You know, we're not under that anymore. God's not looking at that anymore, okay? And so that could be symbolic to that. Then in verse 30, then it says, notice here, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. It doesn't say the Son of Man will appear in heaven. So when judgment happens, we know Lord's going to appear in heaven, right? Clouds, Gabriel's trumpet, we're going to see him. He's going to come back. Okay, clearly we know that takes place. And there's several verses about that. But this says, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Now, so could it be here that maybe, you know, the sign, the great sign is, yes, the destruction of Jerusalem. That's going to be the sign to everyone that Judaism is over with. Okay, it's done with. It's no longer going to be accepted anymore. It's done. That will be the sign. And God and Jesus is still in heaven when that takes place. He will be there. And all the tribes of earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Again, there's other Old Testament passages where it talks about when God's meting out his judgment or when God is meting out his power, that he will come on a cloud. He'll come in a rushing wind. Okay, it's symbolic. It's not really literal. Even though we know that, you know, again, it's confusing here because we do know that God is going to return someday, or Jesus is going to return someday. And it's going to be on a cloud, and it's going to be a trumpet. Okay, but in this case here, maybe he's not referring to that. Then it says in verse 31, and he will send his angels, you know, or messengers. Okay, if you look at that word, it could be messengers with the great sound of a trumpet. and they were to gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. John the Baptist was called a messenger. He was called a messenger for God. So it may be that he's referring here that at that point in time, then, you know, the gospel's going to be spread even further because Judaism will be out of the way. There won't be that great center of influence that's going to persecute the church anymore. It will be gone. And the messengers, those preaching the gospel, will be able to more easily preach the gospel after the destruction of Jerusalem and all of that. So symbolic probably is what this is referring to here in this passage. Now, we could get into a lot more detail in that. I gave you just a quick view. Don, you got any thoughts about that? Okay. All right. If you want to know more about that, you think it'll be probably too much detail for this auditorium class. But anyway, let me know. Thank you very much.